All right. I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, why are they playing sound of the crowd at a Republican National Convention? But the world has spun 180 degrees. Those were the delegates in the hall last night in Philadelphia, Democratic delegates sending up the kind of patriotic cheer we've been used to for decades seeing and hearing at Republican conventions. It's just part of the extraordinary turn of events going on in this year's election campaign. Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nigut. We're live in the Midtown Atlanta studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting. Joining us today, Greg Bluestein, political reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Chip Lake, he's a Republican political strategist. And as we were coming on the air, State Senator Nan Orrick, Democrat from Atlanta, right off the plane from Philadelphia.
That's right. Hot off the press.
Came into the studio. Nan Orrick, you are a true American for making your way here. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Bill.
So I don't know how you all feel out there, because you're all political junkies, like I think everybody who comes into this studio. But I'm always a little sad when conventions come to an end. I went to my first national political convention in 1960. I was heading into eighth grade, and the Republican convention was at the International Amphitheater on the south side of Chicago. Wow. And a good friend of mine and I decided we needed to go down there and be part of the pageantry. We found a delegate from Texas who had a fistful of passes and actually got us inside of the hall. It was the night that Richard Nixon made his acceptance speech. And as we walked in, I think because we were young, somebody handed us Nixon for President placards and said, come with us, me. And we were directed to the hall. We were right beneath the podium, part of the demonstration, as Richard Nixon came in to give his acceptance speech.
Wow.
It was a really remarkable thing to be a part of, to watch. And I've been in love with politics and conventions ever since. And so are the people at the table today. Okay, enough about my memories and reflections. So let's get started, because the campaign now is really engaged, Greg Bluestein. Tell you what we're going to do. I want to give you a chance to weigh in, but why don't we first go to your colleague, Jim Galloway. Jim and I talked a little while ago. He, of course, has been in Philadelphia. Let's listen to my conversation with Jim. Jim Galloway, what was the big takeaway from last night, in your opinion?
That after 36 years, the Democratic Party is now the party of patriotism, optimism, national security, and maybe even religion. That was a Republican convention that we saw last night.
Yeah,
this was the convention that Republicans wished they'd had in Cleveland. I was talking to Whit Ayers. Remember him? He's the pollster.
Sure.
He used to work in Roswell, now has a very, very large Republican polling firm up in D.C. And his point was, Cleveland was not a Republican convention. It was a Trump convention. And that left this huge mantle for Democrats to grab, and they did it. I think they did an excellent job.
Hillary Clinton last night was in the same mode as Reagan was in 1980, a message of hope that if we pull together, we can solve our problems.
Right, and I think we will look back on this and identify the phrase, I alone, as kind of the turning point in this race.
How would you describe the choice that American voters are going to be asked to make?
Times aren't the best right now. You do have a large segment of the American population that a generation ago wasn't on easy street, but they at least had some confidence of making a good living and a secure retirement. That's not there anymore. But I think you go back to Reagan, and we were kind of in a similar situation. The economy was flat, and what Reagan was telling voters was that, yes, things are hard, but you have to pull together. And I think that's the message that Donald Trump doesn't have, and he can't have, because that's not what Donald Trump is.
Nazir Khan last night was astonishing.
I don't know that a vignette that could have been planned in terms of the impact. You can't plan something like that. When he pulled out that little pocket constitution and said, "Here, Mr. Trump, you can have my copy if you like." It was one of the best moments of convention politics that I've ever seen. That clip is going to be pulled out in every community in the United States where you have a group of Muslims who want to build a mosque but are not being allowed to, who are trying to get a parking lot expanded and are not allowed to. I think you're going to see that played everywhere.
Jim, it's been great to talk to you. I know you've got a column to write. Please come back. We want you back in the studio, and we'll see you here next Wednesday at 2. Don't miss it.
All right. You got it.
Thanks, Jim. Safe travels
right.
Home.
Okay.
Jim Galloway reporting from Philadelphia. Greg, before we talk about the most substantive aspects of the conventions, you were in Cleveland, of course, for the Republican convention, and then writing a lot of the stories about Philadelphia from Atlanta. Just in terms of showmanship and consistency of messaging, how do you compare what you saw in the two conventions?
What a contrast in tone, of course. That's another theme that's coming out of these two conventions. There was a, you know, it's hard to argue that there wasn't a pessimistic tone in, out of Cleveland, and we saw totally different 100% 180 on tone in Philadelphia, and also the caliber of speakers. I mean, you had a lot of big name Republicans staying as far as they could away from the Quicken Loans Arena in Cleveland, and there was too much to cover in Philadelphia. I mean, every Wednesday night you had Joe Biden, you had Tim Kaine, you had Barack Obama. And at least Joe Biden and Barack Obama were show-stopping speeches. So you had Michelle Obama on Monday. You had and Bernie Sanders.
Bernie Sanders.
You had so many big names. Whereas we were kind of scrounging for in Cleveland for stories that weren't about the unrest and the protest and because the speakers weren't nearly of the same caliber because so many Republicans like former President Bush stayed away from it.
Nan Orrick, I wanted to give you a second to catch your breath.
Thank you.
You know, forgetting about whether you prefer Donald Trump to, and I know what you do, but prefer in terms of the rest of the listeners out there, forgetting about whether you're supporting Trump or Clinton. I think, Nan Orrick, it is safe to say, I personally have not seen a convention staged with as much drama and excitement as the Democrats this week, as we saw. It was 1992, Bill Clinton's convention at Madison Square Garden in New York. And this one, I don't think the staging from a point of view of drama could have been much better.
The staging was marvelous, and a lot of times you'll see more people in the halls at a convention than you see inside. That was not the case in Philadelphia because there were showstoppers back to back to back. I was particularly inspired by the bringing out the congresswomen, all those women that are members of Congress. Then the next night you had the women senators. You had Elizabeth Warren. Which was, she was subsumed a bit by, she was bookended by these giant speakers. And, it was just a remarkably well done convention. And all of us had just sat through the GOP Cleveland ho-hum the week before. And you just constantly heard that. What a difference this is. What a difference this is. And then I'll tell you. I don't know how much they'll get lifted up. I expect they will. But we had person after person who stood up, and they were a Republican in their past, many times lifelong Republicans, saying, "I'm voting for Hillary,
yeah,
and this is why."
Well, it'll be interesting. We'll see how that develops, of course, because both the Republicans in Cleveland and the Democrats in Philadelphia did attempt to reach out to people of the other parties saying, "Donald Trump, as in Philadelphia, doesn't represent you, vote with us." But of course, the Republicans did the same thing. "We know you don't like Hillary Clinton. Trump may be your guy. You want something new and different," right, Chip Blake?
Yes, Bill, and I hate to come on the show. First of all, I appreciate you having me on Political Rewind again. I hate to come on the show and agree with Senator Nan Orrick, but I do have to.
My goodness,
I do have to agree that the Democrats executed a much better convention than we had. And yesterday, I'll be honest with you, as a Republican, it was tough for me to sit through last night.
Why?
Because we all knew we all knew what was coming as Republicans. And when I say that, I mean we all know that Donald Trump is the nominee of our party. Our convention was last week. We all knew that Hillary Clinton was going to give her acceptance speech yesterday. But to watch all the speakers, to see I think it was Rush Reifer had tweeted, you know, I never thought I would tune into a Democratic National Convention and see American exceptionalism shine so much. And that used to be something that we kind of had ownership.
Yeah, I thought that was one of the most, that's why I started the show by playing the chanting from the hall last night. Nan Orrick, when was the last time you were at a Democratic convention where the hall was chanting USA, USA? Democrats have always thought that was a Republican, that was jingoism on the part of Republicans, but patriotism was on full display this week.
That USA chant has been hurled at demonstrators countless times by right wingers that were opposing a demonstration on this or that progressive issue. The arena was awash with American flags, and red, white, and blue was absolutely the motif, and terrifically embraced. We face a world full of unknowns these days. Who can recall how long it's been since that's been the case? And these news cycles in the next 100 days, I imagine, are going to be one after another. There will be another national or international upheaval of a lone gunman or more. And Americans are looking for leadership. They're looking for some assurance. They're looking for steadiness at the wheel. And I think they got that feel from this convention.
Well, you know, that's important, Greg. A couple things I'd like to ask you to respond to in terms of, I mean, first of all, isn't it true that it was Donald Trump who allowed Democrats to unleash their patriotic side because throughout his convention, this was the Trump convention, as we said, not the Republican convention in many ways. So Democrats suddenly had this freedom to embrace all these values that typically we think of as a Republican sort of motif.
Yeah, I mean, just like what Galloway said, Cleveland was the I Alone convention, where you heard the Republican nominee say that he knew how to fight ISIS better than America's generals.
Yeah.
So that sort of gave clearance for America's generals, or at least retired generals, to go up. And then one of the most more powerful moments, too, is when General John Allen, I think was the retired general, gets on stage in a booming voice, screaming almost, saying that Hillary Clinton was the best candidate who can fight ISIS. And this was someone who had on-the-ground experience in Afghanistan and in Iraq fighting the Islamic terror.
Yeah, he was tough. Chip Lake, I was I was following the New York Times reporters who were following this live on the New York Times website, and Adam Nagorny, one of their great veteran reporters, sent out a message. This guy, talking about General Allen, looks like he eats raw liver. I'm glad he's on the other side of the hall from
me. That's right. That's right. Bill, last night served, from what I could tell, as a survey, it certainly did for me. It was the height of frustration for the nomination of Donald Trump for the Republican Party. Rich Galen, who is no moderate, who is no liberal, and who is no Democrat, who served as Vice President Dan Quayle's press secretary, then I believe he served in the same capacity for Newt Gingrich, tweeted out last night, "How can it be that I am standing at my kitchen counter sobbing because of the messages being driven at the DNC? Where has the GOP gone? And I think that kind of sums it up for all of us.
Well, okay, so I want to play a little bit of what Hillary Clinton said in her acceptance speech, but Trevor, stay with me here because I want to switch things up on you. If you're going to talk about the moments that touched people deeply last night, Nan Orrick, Humayun Khan was a U.S. Army captain who was killed in an attack in Iraq back in, I think, 2004. And, Nan, I assume you were in the hall when his father and mother came forward, and Nasir Khan, who was an American Muslim, had remarks, some of which we'll play for you right now.
Let me ask you, have you even read the United States Constitution? I will gladly lend you my copy. In this document, Look for the words. Look for the words liberty and equal protection of law. Have you ever been to Arlington Cemetery? Go look at the graves of brave patriots who died defending United States of America. You will see all faiths, genders, and ethnicities. You have sacrificed nothing and no one.
Of course, he was directing his remarks at Donald Trump, Nan Orrick. It must have been remarkable to have been there to watch that speech unfold. And it really, really goes at the heart of Donald Trump's message that I'm going to keep you safe from the Muslim terrorists who are attacking this country and will continue to do so. Yes?
Absolutely. And of course, at his side was the mother of the slain soldier in her hijab and traditional dress, and their son's picture of this handsome young man, larger than life, up on the screen. It was an incredibly moving moment, and it was seeing Donald Trump get told in the most high-impact way from a very gracious, thoughtful, mourning father. They had three sons. They have lost a son.
So I think, though, here's where we start looking ahead at what happens in the next 100-plus days. That was an incredibly moving moment, and it certainly worked for the Democrats in the hall last night.
Mm-hmm.
But Donald Trump is talking about two Americans who are afraid of terrorism, who do think that radical jihad is a threat to them, their families, and their country. And without regard to that very moving speech last night, that is what Americans are going to be talking about and looking at as they weigh their votes, yes?
And that's also what's driving the conversation on down-ballot Republicans. If you ask Senator Isaacson, who's running for a third term, what one of the biggest issues is, it is, we need America to declare war on radical Islam. We need to send more special forces into Iraq and Syria to attack some of the Islamic State's apparatus. So it's still driving the message no matter what was said over the last week.
All right. Chip, I want to do something that we're going to play a part of this, not all of it. Before we even get to Hillary Clinton, again, we've talked a lot about how how Democrats seized this message of hope and opportunity that is typically what Republicans have had. So when I got up this morning, I thought, you know what? I think I should go back and listen to Ronald Reagan's acceptance speech at the 1980 Republican convention in Detroit and listen to how he framed his message. As Jim Galloway has already said, in a hard time for this country. So let's listen to just a little bit of what Reagan said in 1980.
It's impossible to capture in words the splendor of this vast continent, which God has granted as our portion of his creation. There are no words to express the extraordinary strength and character of this breed of people we call American. Everywhere we've met thousands of Democrats, independents, and Republicans from all economic conditions, all walks of life, bound together in that community of shared values of family, work, neighborhood, peace, and freedom. They're concerned, yes. They're not frightened. They're disturbed, but not dismayed. They are the kind of men and women Tom Paine had in mind when he wrote during the darkest days of the American Revolution. We have it in our power to begin the world over again.
So that was 1980, Ronald Reagan. And Chip, now let's just listen to a little bit of Hillary Clinton last night.
Powerful forces are threatening to pull us apart. We have to decide whether we will all work together so we can all rise together. We are clear-eyed about what our country is up against. but we are not afraid. We will rise to the challenge, just as we always have. Don't let anyone tell you that our country is weak. We're not. Don't let anyone tell you we don't have what it takes. We do. And most of all, don't believe anyone who says, I alone can fix it.
So, okay, everybody, Chip, I'll start with you. How remarkable. You know, Donald Trump never referred to the great icon of American Republican politics, Ronald Reagan, in his speech. Barack Obama did on Wednesday night. And the parallels between the way in which Hillary Clinton talked about facing the problems of the future and Ronald Reagan did in 1980 are really kind of uncanny.
They're very uncanny. And, Bill, I was really hoping when you played the second part of that clip that you were going to break a story about plagiarism so that we could talk about it. I really was hoping they wouldn't be so close together. I think that was the highlight of the night. That was what stood out to me in her speech. I mean, her, you know, she's not known as a gifted orator. Tim Kaine's not either. I thought she did pretty good. The speech was well written. But when she said, most of all, don't believe anyone who says I can fix it, that, when Donald Trump said that in Cleveland at the speech, as Jim said in the interview that you played at the beginning, you can't back up from that. And here's the crazy part about it. That was not ad-libbed. That was in the speech. He did that on purpose. I mean, the problems that exist in this country have to be solved they have to be solved together. No one person can solve any of these problems. So it's very disappointing as a Republican. And look, you know, he opened the door for her to kind of put that in her speech, and they drove a truck through it and did very well with it.
But you know, I really do think that that's the choice the nation's facing. That's the choice the nation's facing. A vision of coming together and moving toward a better world for all of us versus continuing this reality that the voters loathe. They hate gridlock. They don't delight in all the tales of who knocked who apart in the last. Voters don't like gridlock. Voters don't like gridlock. And she hearkened back to the Philadelphia founding fathers who first wanted to stick it to the king and others wanted to stick it to the king and leave. But
yeah,
they came together. They came together instead.
Yeah, I got
busting
you.
Apart and they created a more perfect union.
I got to tell you, Nan, when she started her speech with that stuff, I got it. But I turned to my wife and I said, oh, this is weak.
Yeah, she used that line before.
I don't think it's weak to reach back in history and look at historic.
Okay.
We're in Philadelphia, the Liberty Bell, her point was, we're stronger together. They came together. They started in different corners of that room fighting each other.
Dan Orrick has been looking at those stronger together signs for 4 days. Go ahead.
I fundamentally, in my heart and soul, believe that collective, cooperative action.
Of course.
That's right. And women actually tend to embrace that.
I get it. Greg, before we go to break, I want to give you a chance.
Yeah, and if you look at how many times she must have said we during that speech, as a contrast to I Alone, it was probably more than 100. And also, one of the most powerful lines of the whole week wasn't from her, it was from President Obama, which is something I'm paraphrasing, but we don't look to be ruled. Right? He said we don't look to be ruled as the counter to.
Yes.
And I just that resonated with the audience, I think.
All right, so we're going to take a break. But there's a lot of comments here, even from Republican Chip Lake, about what a good job the Democrats have done. But this is a long election. It is a very, there's no question it's a tight election. There are themes that Donald Trump is putting forward that are finding great resonance out there in the electorate. And so I think as we move forward in the show, we should talk about how we see this whole thing playing out. But you know what, Trevor, as we go to break, another one of the great Republican icons for a couple of decades was a man who I think we should listen to a little bit of as we go to the break. At the 1984 convention in Dallas, Texas, Elizabeth Dole came to the podium and introduced this entertainer who sang a song that became the theme of Republican gatherings wow. for decades since. To be an American, when at least I know I'm free. And I won't forget the men who died, who gave that right to me. And I gladly stand up next to you and defend her still today. Cause there ain't no Lee Greenwood. God bless the USA, the Republican theme for so many years. So have the Democrats co-opted patriotism and cohesiveness, or does Donald Trump still have a big message to share with the American people? We'll talk about that after the break. It's 3:31. You're listening to Political Rewind.
Democratic vice presidential candidate Tim Kaine is vocal about his Catholic faith.
We had a motto in my school, men for others. And it was there that my faith became something vital, my North Star for orienting my life.
Faith, politics, and Catholic voters who make up more than 20% of the electorate. Later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Starting today at 4 on GPB.
You're listening to Political Rewind on Georgia Public Broadcasting, an 18-station radio network. I'm Ellen Reinhart. Thank you for joining us. GPB Atlanta is licensed to Georgia State University with 8 colleges and schools, including the Andrew Young School of Policy Studies.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. We're here with State Senator Nan Orrick, who is just back from being a delegate at the Democratic Convention in Philadelphia. I mean, literally just back. She came here from Hartsfield. Thanks for being here, Nan. Chip Lake, a Republican strategist, joining us again in the studio. It's always a pleasure to have Greg Bluestein, political reporter for the AJC, with us. You can tweet us at PoliticsGPB. Jeffrey McLaughlin has already sent us a tweet. He says, Hillary's not a great speaker, but her party is who Americans are in 2016, multicultural, patriotic, and optimistic. Again, Politics GPB, if you want to join our conversation. Greg, what do we, if we agree, and you tell me if I'm wrong, that among many things that conventions do, aside from rallying the troops and giving people who have been working hard for the party a chance to showcase themselves, if it's true that the conventions are what establishes the themes that candidates will run on for the rest of the race, how do you describe the difference between the Republicans and the Democrats?
Republicans are clearly on a law and order, protect the country, make the streets safe again. It's one of the things Donald Trump said in his acceptance speech was, I will make the streets safer again. And right after that, he started highlighting statistics that he said showed that violent crime is on the rise and that terror is a constant threat. And for Democrats, Nan said it earlier, it's working together, it's cohesiveness, it's, you know, together we can build a stronger nation.
Chip, one of the problems, let's break down a couple of the problems that Hillary Clinton has and talk about whether she addressed them, whether they're going to haunt her as we move forward. Mm-hmm. Number one, on one hand, she has to embrace President Obama, because he obviously he's got high approval ratings again. And she was part of his administration. She can't very well completely distance herself from him. But in embracing him, she then has to find a way to break away from an economic reality in which Americans really are, as Trump has said, they're not doing as well as they were a decade ago, for instance. So she has to somehow strike out on her own, because clearly voters, one of the reasons they're going to Trump is that they don't believe they've been getting what they deserve out of this administration. How did she do on that score?
I think she's going to struggle with that for the remainder of the election. I think the next 3.5-4 months, that is going to be the sweet spot that she's got to try to find. I mean, as I've said on this show before, we've waited 20 years as Republicans for the Democratic Party to give Hillary Clinton their chance to be the nominee for president. And they did that. And then we have Donald Trump as our nominee. And so she's going to have to strike that balance. It's going to be a very tough balance to strike. But she is also the beneficiary of a mistake that we made.
Nan Orrick, the other issue that she struggles with is her likability. and her trustworthiness. There were people who thought that that was one of the key things that she should address in her speech last night. She went a different direction. I think she, I can't read her mind, but she chose to show us that she is strong, compassionate, helping in bringing us all together. But she didn't really go directly to a point that many people wished she had made, which is I've been the victim of 25 years of demonization, and I want you to start to get to know me in a new way. What do you think?
Well, she said she introduced her life story by saying that, you know, many people have had a hard time figuring me out. And then she told that compelling story, that strong mother, that Marine, that petty officer father who built a business, and the Methodist values that were planted in her.
Her mother was, I did not know. I've known the Clintons since
her mother was abandoned by her parents.
Yeah.
Yes, abandoned by her parents. Left to go to the corner store with some coupons to buy her own food when she remains alone overnight in their walk-up tenement. I think that throughout the week we heard from people who had met and encountered Hillary Clinton at different points, whether they were 9/11 survivors, someone who had lost a child, someone who is struggling to make ends meet. And people talked in compelling ways about her. And we've not mentioned it here, but I thought Chelsea Clinton's wonderfully natural, authentic embracing of her mother and those stories she told about when mom was away, she would leave me an envelope each day with a
message. Want to hear a little, just a very short bit of Hillary Clinton? We have that? No, we don't have it. Okay,
but I think that she struck the note of here's her family story, and of course Bill told the 30-year romance, and he told that
the chronology.
The chronology.
Wait a second.
I'm not going to let you say that, Bill. here is my point. Throughout the week, she was humanized and normalized, and talked about very warmly by people from all walks of life. And then her daughter introduces her with that truly beautiful speech that is a daughter, a mother, and a grandmother now.
That's
who we can have at the helm of our country.
If I could, Nan, what was the feeling in the convention hall after Chelsea got done speaking? And I agree with you. I think she did a tremendous job, and I think she did humanize Hillary Clinton.
Uh-huh.
But would you have rather seen the video played before Chelsea spoke so that the transition could go directly from Chelsea talking about her mother and introducing her mother? It almost seems like it was a little bit anticlimactic. What was the feeling within the hall when that was going on?
You know, you're right in the sense that there were two highlights. Chelsea was a highlight, and then the film was a highlight.
Yeah.
What happened immediately after the film? She came out, and people were just overwhelmed and just struck, and about how great she looks and how
this is still
confident.
One of the least likable political leaders in politics today.
And
Greg,
that's
going to
change. That's going to change over the next time.
Except for her opponent.
Yeah, well,
who
right.
is,
yeah,
well, exactly.
Which is the genesis of my frustration.
And I think that's part of what her speech did was it sort of embrace the fact that no matter what she does or says over the next few months, there will always be an element within Republicans and Democrats that see her as untrustworthy. That was one of the shocking things that came out of the primaries is that, even a lot of her supporters said they'll never see her as totally trustworthy, but that she's now positioning herself as, I get it. I get that I'll never be a beloved figure like maybe Barack Obama was, but I am the best candidate to bring cohesiveness to bring a sense of unity to this party and to this nation.
All right. If you start, you kind of have a zero. You zero the counters here. Trump is not trusted by the American people. Clinton is not trusted by the American people. So start with that as a baseline. Then, Chip, it's the messages about the future that really are going to be what Americans vote on, right? Donald Trump says build walls. Donald Trump says we do have good reason to be fearful of immigration, refugee. We already talked about this a little. That message sells to a lot of people. Hillary Clinton says, yeah, we've got tremendous problems and challenges, but we have to be what we've always been, a country that embraces diversity, that welcomes people of all religions. That when it comes right down. And the next question is, I think, the other main message is, is this a change election? And if it's a change election, doesn't Donald Trump have a good chance of winning?
I don't think the fact that it's a change election increases Donald Trump's chance of winning. And let me explain to you why. People are frustrated with the two-party system. They're disaffected with it. The Republicans nominated what I would call a Democrat. I think Donald Trump has been a Democrat up until now. And the Democrats almost nominated a socialist. So the country is changing. They do want change. But I think a byproduct of that is going to be, and I don't have a crystal ball to know what's going to happen after November, but I think for the first time in American history, you're going to see third-party candidates, Gary Johnson and Jill Stein, the Green Party candidate. I would not be surprised at all, Bill, if once we get to Election Day, you add up the percentage of votes that they get in the popular vote, and it exceeds 25%. And so you're still going to have the two major parties, either Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton will be president of the United States, but we're going to have a conversation moving forward on, are we going to continue as a healthy two-party system, or is there an opportunity because of the change mood that the electorate is in? Is there an opportunity for a third party to emerge and possibly, start getting seats in legislatures and maybe becoming candidates for Congress and so on and so on?
Nan, Bill Clinton on Tuesday night. I thought he did something interesting and surprising. He tried to make the case that Hillary Clinton is an agent of change, that she is the best, what was his phrase, the best darn, I don't think he used the expression change agent. But
change, that was, change maker.
Change maker.
All right. But pretty hard to sell that, isn't it?
Well, this is the woman that stood up for universal health care in 1992, 93, 94. And then went on, when blocked from that avenue, went on to put into place a children's health insurance program with bipartisan support. 8 million kids covered. We welcomed those health dollars and that coverage when they came into Georgia. It was an incredible for families that earning $42,000 or below. That was huge. I think there were so many highlights to her accomplishments. And go back to Arkansas, where they were at the bottom of the heap when she came in as the first lady, and transformed preschool and on and on and on, and moved them numerically up the charts to where they were considered a great place for kids. So yes, it's a narrative that hasn't been told, but I think they're very much the fabric of that story is there in the life that she's lived and the things that she's done.
Thank you. Let me bring this back to Georgia and what we expect to unfold here over the next 100-plus days. Ted Terry is the mayor of Clarkston. He was a pretty adamant Bernie Sanders delegate in the Georgia delegation at the convention. He was responsible, according to Greg's colleagues at the AJC, in the early nights, was trying hard, despite the fact he was a Sanders supporter, to quiet down the disruptiveness of some of his fellow Sanders delegates. I talked to him earlier today, about 11 o'clock this morning, and I thought we should listen to a little bit about where a Bernie delegate in Georgia like Ted Terry is headed in the weeks ahead.
Well, I think you saw a lot of unity, after President Obama's, endorsements, and I think well put, reasons for why Hillary Clinton should be president. I think a lot of our Bernie supporters and delegates, not only in Georgia, but around the arena, saw a very clear choice between someone who is definitely qualified to be president versus someone who really has no qualifications to be president. And so I think you saw a lot of unity last night. It was very exciting.
Do you, as you talk to people in Georgia delegation, sense that there's going to be unity around Hillary Clinton?
Well, I think with the general public, people who supported Bernie and donated Bernie, voted for Bernie during the primary process, I think the vast majority of those are voting Democrat this year, and they're voting for Hillary Clinton. Now, obviously, our delegates are sort of the most hardcore activist Bernie supporters. And so there's still a couple who, saying they're going to go to a third party, vote for, Jill Stein and the Green Party. We had most of our Bernie delegates have a more practical view of the situation and do believe that Hillary would certainly be a better choice than Donald Trump. And so, there's still a few folks who probably just need to kind of, recover from a really long, hard-fought campaign. We have very passionate people in that movement, but we're going to continue that movement. So it's not like we're, just sort of packing up and going home. I think the progressive movement in Georgia is still strong and is going to continue.
What about you, Ted? Are you firmly in the Hillary Clinton camp?
Of course. Yeah, definitely. You know, I actually voted for Hillary in 2008, and I actually worked for Obama during his campaign in 2008 as well, after the primary was over. And, 100% behind the nominee and going to be working to get all of our Bernie supporters on board for November.
Ted Terry, the mayor of Clarkston, Bernie Sanders delegate at the convention. We talked to him about 11 o'clock this morning. Greg Bluestein, and Nan was in the hall, so she might have a reaction, too. But last night, even as Hillary Clinton started speaking, those hardcore Bernie people were trying to disrupt. They were jeering, catcalls. That was one of the reasons we heard all those USA cheers to cover up the catcalls. Is there how important is this disruptive element of the Sanders folks?
It's important, and there was also a WikiLeaks sign that was put up. It's important, but remember, just as Mayor Terry said, these are people who raised $5,000-$10,000 on their own just to be able to go to the convention to support Bernie Sanders. So they might not be representative of the entire Sanders block. And remember, Sanders got maybe about a quarter of the votes in Georgia's primary. So Hillary Clinton won overwhelmingly. It might play a bigger factor in other states that she lost. Trump has said Georgia is one of the 17 states he must win to have any chance at the election. For Hillary Clinton, this would be a cherry on top, but it's definitely not a must-win state. A Democrat has won Georgia since 1992.
But for Georgia Democrats, it matters.
Shirley Franklin pointed out to me, and she was president. Of course, she co-chaired.
Yeah, she was on here right before she left for Philadelphia. I'm glad to say.
Yeah, wonderful, wonderful. I mean, she pointed out to me. She said she was looking at the numbers, and a win in Georgia would more than offset. You could lose Pennsylvania. You could look there. It's a big pile of votes here that you can collect.
But you'd admit that's an outside possibility, wouldn't you?
Well, they're polling even now, and I tell you what, I met some great young Bernie supporters in Georgia that are going to go back and work their fingers to the bone to get Hillary elected. I've got pictures of them up on my Facebook. They're young organizers. They've got great spirit. They've got great chutzpah and idealism.
Yeah, nice Yiddish.
Yeah, thank you. I'm working on it. I was a little slow behind the curve, but I'm working on it. And in fact, there's a Facebook picture right there of me with one of the Bernie delegates. And they pointed out constantly that in our delegation, we didn't have a lot of push and shove and friction. There are a lot of young activists who, and we welcomed them with open arms. There'll be a couple, like Ted Terry said.
If you want to see Nan's Facebook page, it's Nan, O-R-R-O-C-K. You can search her on Facebook there.
And the AJC will actually have a post-convention poll coming out around this time next week, and a big story in Sunday's paper about whether or not Georgia's competitive. A little sneak preview. We talked to one of Hillary Clinton's state campaign managers, Marla Marshall, who said, at this point, they're not pouring in resources into Georgia yet. You'd know it if they were. You'd see it on the ads. You'd see more visits. Hillary Clinton hasn't visited Georgia since before the primary, but they're still monitoring the state. North Carolina, Florida, those are the other southern states they're focusing on more now. But, things could change.
Yeah, Chip Nanorek referred to it, the Landmark poll for WSB-TV, and Landmark's pretty reputable polling firm, had it as an even race. This was prior to the Democratic convention, and I think you may know this better than I think it actually kind of caught the tail end of the Republican convention when they were
Sunday.
In the field.
They did it Sunday.
Following the Republican?
Following the Republican.
Okay, so they did catch a bit of the Republican. But do we, come on, is Georgia really in play?
I think you're going to see a lot of states, Bill, that are in play. I mean, when you look at a traditional map for general election presidential allocation, as we were talking about in one of the breaks, I mean, you've got states like Minnesota and Pennsylvania, in which Donald Trump seems to be polling better than he is in states like Georgia and Mississippi and even Utah. I think with Gary Johnson on the ballot. And so, yeah, I don't know the Republicans could take it for granted. You know, the demographics of the state have been changing very quickly. And there are, you know, a lot of Republicans that recognize that and are very respectful to that dynamic. But I can tell you there are a lot of Republicans that just don't buy it. And sooner or later, and I don't know when it will be, but sooner or later, we are going to learn a lesson that the numbers are changing. And if we don't you know, make adjustments to that, we could lose. So absolutely, I think this state can be competitive, especially with, you know, you're going to have four people on the ballot that are going to get votes. We don't normally see that at all.
Okay, let me give you a couple of tweets that have come in. Barbara S. says, oh, for heaven's sake, with an exclamation point. If Hillary had talked about being demonized, which I referred to earlier, folks would have said she was whining. Edward Funt says, a steamroller got rolling last night. Who would have guessed? It's Trump himself selling tickets to hop on board. Well, we'll see. All right. Speaking of Donald Trump, and then I want to come back to Georgia, but I do want to give the Republican candidate some time on this show. I think that's important. We did the same for Hillary Clinton when we were talking about the Republican convention. So Trump has been out on the stump. You know, he's been making very highly visible appearances. It's kind of against the tradition that we've had in this country for a long time. But hey, this is Donald Trump. What do we expect? So Trump the other day, yesterday, was responding to some of the things that he has heard watching the Democratic convention. Let's listen.
You know, I've been watching these speeches at night, and boy, am I getting hit. Whoa, whoa, whoa. I am getting hit, and they don't mean it, and there's a lot of lies being told, but I guess they have to do their thing. I guess they have to do their thing. I mean, the things that were said about me. I mean, should I go through some of the names? Sure. No. I wanted to hit a couple of those speakers so hard, I would have hit them. No. But I watched last night, and they're not talking about the real world, you know. They're not talking about radical Islamic terrorism. They're not talking about borders where people just pour across. They're not talking about the crime, the kind of crime that we have in this nation. They're not talking about the fact that many people in our country are making less money today in terms of real wages than they were making 18 years ago. They're not talking about that. People are tired, we're fighting, we don't get along with anybody, and yet they we don't get along with China, but they rip us off. We don't get along with Russia. Wouldn't it be nice if we actually got along with Russia? Wouldn't it be nice? I mean, is there something wrong?
All right, Donald Trump on the stump in Iowa. Dan Horak had a strong reaction to that. So Greg Bluestein, if you're Johnny Isaacson up for re-election, in November, if you're any number of Republican legislators up for re-election here in this state, members of Congress are pretty well set. Most of them don't have any kind of opposition at all. But nevertheless, down ballot races in Georgia, do you worry about us being stuck with that?
I know that Senator Isaacson's campaign sure is. I mean, you've got an opponent who not many people know of, who's sort of a blank slate, which could work for him and against him.
Yeah, but what we do know about Jim Barksdale is mostly negative, unfortunately, because he hasn't done much of a job.
He hasn't really gotten out there, but he also has already put $3 million plus into his own campaign and can put more millions more in. And so Isaacson's camp is a little bit worried about that. You're already seeing them go after him pretty hard. You're seeing the Georgia GOP get in. And you're seeing Johnny Isaacson say, yes, I am for the candidate at the top of the ticket, but you're not going to see him put on the Make America Great Again hat that David Perdue put on. You're seeing him say, my first and foremost responsibility is to get myself reelected and keep the Senate in Republican hands. So, and you're also seeing Jim Barksdale try to tie him in the few statements he's made to the media, tie him as much as they can to Donald Trump, because that's the specter that's looming over this race.
Dan Orrick, I thought Democrats, one of the other messages that was repeated on a number of occasions in this past week in Philadelphia was about down ballot races. And one speaker after another said, you need to hold your legislators at various levels accountable if they're Republicans for the guy at the head of their ticket.
Exactly. Exactly. I think that that's precisely why Mitch and Paul Ryan look so pained as they, you know,
Mitch
very gingerly. Yes.
When he speaks.
Yeah. And we've never seen anything like it. And I frankly am very proud of Republicans that I know that have said, you know, this I will not go. This far, I will not embrace
if
this
you're,
man.
Yeah, if you're down ballot and you're Republican, you better take nothing for granted because we've never seen anything like this before. And if history tells us anything, then you can expect that there's going to be some collateral damage down the ticket. Not so sure that happens. I mean, there were no coattails in the primary. General elections are different animals. We'll see. But Johnny Isaacson's not taking anything for granted, and I think everybody else running for Senate is also in the same position that he is.
All right. I want to just share another tweet with you. Michael Littlefield wanted to make sure we had the numbers right. He tweets, WSB TV poll, July 25th, Trump 46.2, Clinton 44.9. But the reality is that's a dead heat when you include
the margin of error.
Was
4%.
Yeah, so I mean, so it is a dead heat. We were not trying to mislead anybody with our figures. We are completely out of time. For today's show. Nan Orick, thank you so much for jumping off a plane and being here.
Great to be with you.
Pleasure. Chip Lake,
thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bill.
And Greg Bluestein, always love having you here on Political Rewind. Look, we have a very exciting year ahead at 100-plus
The
days
debates
ahead.
Will be fun.
The debates are going to be remarkable. They start in mid-September, 3 presidential, 1 vice presidential. We'll be covering all of that. But we'll be back as usual on Wednesdays at 2 and Fridays at 3. My thanks to my remarkable senior producer, Jenny Ament, producer Trevor Young, our board engineer, Tyler Morris, and Caroline Hayes, our intern, heads back to the University of Georgia after today's show. And Caroline, we have loved having you with us. It's been just a thrill. You've been a great asset to us. So good luck in school. Think about us every now and then. Tell you what, as we go out today, do you have your own music picked out? Because if you do, great, but I think we should go out with Lee Greenwood. What do you think about that? Trevor, you want to bring it? I'm sorry. I know I'm messing you up in there. But I think, you know, everybody loves Lee Greenwood. So why don't we go out with Lee Greenwood? And I wanted to just take a quick minute to tell you that this weekend on Two Way Street, really interesting show. Kevin Young, one of the most acclaimed poets of his generation, will be with us. And Jim Ockmoody talks about Koinonia, the interracial communal farm in America's Georgia that was at the heart of a lot of problems in the segregated South Georgia community. Lee Greenwood, take us out of the show. We'll see you next Wednesday at 2:00.